Hopefully everybody has the materials. We received a fair amount of feedback from council members, chamber, RDA, RCVB, or at least those were all the groups that we sent the survey to. Again, the format of the information was we broke down kind of the current ordinance and what it says, and then we gave people an option of what they'd like to see if we made changes going forward. Now, ideally, again, with that sense of urgency, ideally, we could work through this document, hopefully, or make some comments, and then if it's sufficiently buffed up, hand it off to the city attorney's office to codify it into the appropriate language, and then hopefully we'll take some action on this in April. So, hopefully you got the memorandum that I sent out as well, because I think one of the open questions was the fee and what would be an appropriate and acceptable fee. So we'll work through that as well. So I'm open to how you'd like to work through this, if you just want to work through that list of questions that was on the document and see if we can. I think many of those will be very, very quick. They're almost, without saying, but nevertheless, they're on the list. What would you like to do, Mr. Wojcik?
Well, I just had some general questions. Starting on page 5, somebody wrote up a City of Rochester food truck franchise fee, but I'm not sure who came up with some of that stuff.
Let me get to that. I'm sorry.
And there's not a name on it?
I did it based I did it based on two models. One, well, actually the data came from staff. Terry, did you come up with some of the property tax data? That's where the calculated $5.50 came from that we used. And then I think it was Tony that came up with some data on parking meter revenue. And again, these were just ways to put some number out there to give us a starting point for discussion. That's all they were meant to be.
My only question was, my understanding, and I assume this is still the case, is that, again, we can't charge fees greater than the value of what they're paying for.
This is
not a license fee.
This is a franchise.
So, right. What do we have any restrictions on that?
No. Okay. So, where would you like to go with that, or further comments on Mr. Russell?
I'd like to go through the table. I think we've got some of our responses here. That way, we can kind of, if there's any kind of conflict or just disagreements, we can talk about it here, get some consensus. You've got feedback from, I didn't see any from the chamber, but I did see it from the RDA and the CVB.
Right.
And then as well as council members and the mayor on basically some of the main issues here. So it would seem to me like I agree, if we go through it, there's a lot of things here that are going to be pretty uncontentious and so on, but there might be a couple that we probably need. I don't know how else we get to the bottom of it unless we go that route. So
right.
It's just a thought. I'm open to other ideas.
We can do that, see how far we get. And we can come back to Michael's question, because again, that is probably one of the more open items. All right with that? Hopefully it'll go quickly. The first one is just, this is, again, a lot of these are in our current ordinance that you need to have a license. And Mr. Adkins, does that refer to a vehicle license, or what's the specific sort of license? I don't remember offhand.
It's a permit to have been from a truck.
Okay.
It's just a permit to engage in that activity.
Okay. And currently, you do not need that if you're on private property.
We regulate only vending from public right-of-way?
Right-of-way. So that might be a question. Should all of these businesses be required to have that license, whether they're on public or private? Do you have an opinion, Mr. Bildebeck?
My question, Mr. Adkins, can we say what they have to have on private property?
No.
That's not the answer.
That one I haven't looked at. Well,
I think that's fair, though, but they still have to do all the food, the health department stuff.
Right.
So if we could leave that as is, which essentially says a license is required if you're operating in public right-of-way.
Right.
If you're on private property. Mr. Wojcik?
Again, I can state my opinions on these, but I think the most valuable people who haven't really been heard from, enough in the process and should review our work before we finalize it is the actual food truck entrepreneurs. And I certainly want to get their feedback on this as well, as you know, as they're the ones that are going to be trying to promote the businesses.
Well, and that's why we said we would hold a public hearing. Mm-hmm. But I think the goal, or at least my objective, was to give them something to react to. As you can see, we've got a number of opinions already. It'd be nice to see where we're at.
Yep.
Because we have been, we've received a fair amount of comment from a variety of folks. So, let's keep moving on this thing. So, Ms. Means.
I did have a comment. Tell me if I can. Yes, no. This is the license required, yes.
Okay.
That's just number one.
Okay. So, a license is still required if operating in the public right away.
Yeah.
All right, let's skip over the fee for the moment. The third one says mobile food handler license. That's the public health item, which says that it should be required. I think we would all agree that it can still be required. All right. Ms. Means?
Are those requirements, have you looked into that at all, about what, how long it would take them, or what is their time availability to do that prior to passing or agreeing upon the food truck licensing?
To obtain those licenses and so forth?
How long is that process, do you think they do?
Well, this is nothing new, so so having the public health sign off is something that's customary already. Same for insurance. It's required that they carry an appropriate level of insurance. And again, I don't know what the exact language was, but the point of this item was that it should still be required.
I agree.
You all right with that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Equipment required, and this is largely safety equipment on the vehicle itself. You have to have mirrors, signal lamps, horn, etc. Much as described in the current ordinance. Are you all right with that, or Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, I think just looking at the chart, I think Mr. Campion points out that if we're heading towards zones, then maybe flashing lights wouldn't be required. I mean, obviously they'd have them on the vehicle, but they wouldn't be required to operate them while they're vending. And I think that's, from looking at the current ordinance summary, it looks like that's the situation, huh?
Yeah, I think the current ordinance, there's an assumption that they're moving.
Right.
So you'd have to have flashing lights as you're in motion. So that makes sense. I mean, if you're parked in a zone, obviously you don't need to have your lights flashing.
Well, I'm not even sure if their vehicle operates, if it's operational to the highway or the city or the road, why they would even need their flashing lights when they're moving. I would like... There's no need in my mind that they should have flashing lights at all.
So the clause that says...
They should be doing traffic.
The clause that says special flashing lights to be used while stopped, I'm hearing that we could strike that.
Strike that, yeah.
And I don't make any claim to be an expert on food trucks, and that's why a bunch of my answers are copy Minneapolis, because it seems to be working fantastic up there.
Yeah. I just don't see the need to have them.
So the current ordinance says these lamps shall display two alternating flashing yellow lights on the front and two alternately flashing yellow lights on the rear of the vehicle. That's the sentence you want to strike?
Yes.
Okay.
And I guess the following one, then, too.
I'm sorry?
I would assume the following one.
The next sentence says both lights must be visible at 500 feet in normal sunlight on a straight level street.
Yeah, if we're taking the flashing lights off.
Okay, take out those two sentences.
So just a lot of other ordinances, what we've updated them is we just refer to some other standard that's out there. And if there's an opportunity to do that with this ordinance, that would still be my preference. That way we don't get into this mixing and updating things as things change.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have any access to a uniform standard on food trucks. I don't know of anything I can incorporate by reference.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My question is, will we have the fire department and the police department and public works and weigh in on this in case there is something that they require or would want to be aware of before we all agree to consensus on this? I don't know. Since I don't know about, you know, food trucks, I was hoping that the health department, those people that are there to give us direction and advice, either they concur or not, or make suggestions. And that is why I had the comments that I do and the column under my name.
I mean, I would strongly suggest that we instruct the city administrator to make sure everyone's aware that we're proposing to change the ordinance that they review. I mean, the department should review everything that we do. I would expect to have their feedback going forward.
And again, we're not adopting anything today. The idea is to come up with a draft that could then be shared with interested parties and then presented in a public hearing.
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Campion, and then I think we'd all be more comfortable, at least that the professional staff has reviewed it and don't have any issues with it.
All right. The next one is inspection. All that really says is that at least the vehicle must be inspected at least annually by a qualified mechanic to ensure that it's appropriately safe. Problem with that? The next one down, I was actually a little not quite sure what that meant. Operator training must provide documentation of training program. I don't know what that means or the value of that exactly. I mean, certainly they have to be licensed if they're driving the vehicle, but
that's what I was taking it to mean when we were filling it out, was that the driver would have to have, I mean, this just seems absurd to put in our ordinance, probably. We can probably strike it, in my opinion. The assumption is that whoever's operating the vehicle has the authority.
It's a one-sentence ordinance. It says, an applicant for a license shall provide a description with his application for license of any operator training program, including documentary material used in said program. So that's more than a DL. It refers to...
It says that they must present, but it doesn't say that there's an obligation to have attended.
Or there's any consequences for not doing it or not having it.
Well, there is. You can take action administratively against the license for any violation.
To me, that falls under almost as employee training, and that's the burden on the burden of the business. I don't know that I want to see any of that. As long as they're a licensed driver, that's largely what I care about in terms of our public responsibility.
I would think the other stuff would be covered by the health department, public health and things of that nature.
Food handling and so forth.
So my whole concern would be that they have a valid driver's license.
Yes, Mr. Campion?
So can you read the line to me one more time? City attorney, you just had it.
It's 143A.07. An applicant for a license shall provide a description with his application for license of any operator training program, including documentary material used in that program.
And it's later in the ordinance, it indicates how those materials will be used to authorize approval of said license. I'm just confused because it kind of suggests that you could have that, but it doesn't really say anything about what it's used for.
No, it does not.
Okay. I'd just assume strike it. It seems superfluous.
I just assume have it just say that they have to provide a valid driver's license. I don't think we want to get into the public health realm of determining what type of food or what kind of classes they need to have for food.
That would be the job of the health department to make sure that they're aware of food handling procedures. Mr. Freeze?
Just might offer some further thought on that is that being able to drive the truck is one thing. Being able to operate it once it's parked is maybe quite another. You've got potentially fryers and other electrical equipment, some that may be operated by propane or other things. You've got disposal, the potential for disposal of materials that may need to occur. There's valves that could be turned where things could be discharged to the street, or into a storm drain or something like that. So I think knowing how to operate the vehicle is more almost as important as being able to know how to drive it.
But my question is, who here would be able to do that? I mean, making that for somebody to do. Who is here in the city that has that responsibility?
I don't know the responsibility, but I can say that that's what the city of Minneapolis requires with their application, is basically how you operate your cart. So they want to see equipment lists and cut sheets on everything that is used, details on food preparation methods and processes, some various things about the equipment, copy of the standard operating procedures for cleaning and sanitizing the equipment and vehicle at the affiliated licensed food establishment, documented process for filling fresh water, documented process for dumping gray water, things like that. So that's, I think, what Richard's getting to is it's, Minneapolis does require that they provide the documentation. Well, here's how we do take care of the actual food cart. Here's how we will dispose of the gray water.
Is this a situation where it'd be just as easy to just copy the language out of the Minneapolis ordinance? Mr. Hickey?
So I guess that goes back to the question. So if we required it, I mean, who would review it?
Right.
I mean, you're going to have them submit this, and then it's just going to go in a file, and no one's going to look at it. I mean, if we're not going to review it, and we're not going to have someone be responsible for enforcing it, I'm not sure what's the point.
Mr. Nigber has a question.
I think it's the enforcement part of it. If we see people starting to dump their gray water into the street or into the park, that'd be a real concern from our standpoint. We have something, at least in documentation, that you're not supposed to be doing that.
Mr. Bildeback.
Why don't we ask public health what they do as far as the training and education? Because it seems to me like this is probably more of a public health responsibility, and we can at least find out if they're what they do in their inspection. And what they do when they license these vehicles, what do they talk to them about? Because I think it wouldn't make sense for us to duplicate the services, but if public health is doing that, then let's let them do that. That'd be a part of their licensing.
Sure. You could ask what they require and what they document as need.
And that gets back to the point that I said we also should let our department heads take a look at it and see how,
sure,
you know, if there's smoke looming out of the charter house, maybe that would be effective. Just it would affect some people.
I think if it's not covered, I agree with you, Ms. Means. And I think if it's not covered by public health, then it's something in there, and maybe even in something in there for if they violate, how we can turn around and use an administrative fee against them. But I think we should check with public health before we make more rules.
I'm pretty sure too that this will probably be in the state application, which is another way they can get their approval. So.
Say that again?
I think that some of the, I think the state application that some of these food trucks go through includes the same information.
I'm not aware of any state licensure.
Oh, I think there's a, I think there is a.
Aaron, are you aware?
It would just be the health department health license.
Which actually delegates to the county health department.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm
with
Homestead County Public Health.
Ah,
there we go.
Thank you.
Quick, get him.
We would see the city much like an event organizer who was kind of coordinating and working with all the vendors on site. So we work with event organizers like the North County Fair or any event, even Thursdays on First and Third, to make sure that the vendors who are showing up are prepared to deal with, you know, wastewater. That kind of thing. In fact, I called the state for that. I'm trying to understand where you guys are going with this, because while we look at it, it's much more proactive to work with the vendors to make sure they have a plan in place. And so yes, when we license them, we do a full plan review on the unit, their procedures, that kind of thing, and it comes up.
And so you issue the license.
We issue the license.
Well, do people, can they go through either you or the state? Because can't the trucks also go through the state?
They can, and we do, I guess, recognize state licenses for mobile food units, but we work with the state to make sure if they're primarily operating in Homestead County, they'll get Homestead County Public Health Services.
Are they required to get one from the state as well?
If they go outside of Homestead County, yes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so there are some mobile food units that operate around the state who will honor that state license.
So if they violate, what do you do?
Well, we make sure that they resolve the issue. We would consider it a condition. During inspection, we would deal with it also on a complaint basis. It can't be everywhere all the time. So we would work with them to resolve it. We would want to make sure they have a plan in place to deal with it, obviously resolve the problem.
Can you take action against their Olmsted County issued license?
Sure.
Absolutely. If they have a state license, I mean, are you actually requiring them to get a county license or?
No.
Okay.
Well, we would recognize the state license to operate within.
And even if they're principally just doing business down here, the state one's still okay.
They would probably defer to us in that case.
Okay.
Yeah, unless the operator, we'd probably have to have a conversation among the operator and the state health department.
All right.
So is it correct that, have you had an opportunity to review some of the information that was in the packet for today?
I'm just looking at it now.
Perfect timing. Are there a number of these things that we do not need to have legislative authority over that we could just defer to the county on?
Well, I know, for example, the license, obviously, we would cover that in the routine inspection.
The interesting part to me is this operator training. It sounds as though that they have to have some conceptual knowledge of what they're doing in order to obtain a license from you. Is that true or false?
Yeah, they need to know how to operate their units.
Do they show you how they operate them?
You don't do that when you...
Sometimes. Okay. Sometimes we may get to that point, but typically we don't have
the
fly
a helicopter.
We're there when they're setting up.
Do you issue anything that indicates that they have complied with your training programs or have obtained the needed information on how to operate and run a truck?
Well, it would be the license.
It would be the license itself. So a blanket requirement that they be licensed either through the state or Olmsted County should cover the bases.
It should. And then any other issues that come up, we would defer to, like, plumbers or...
Pardon?
Any other issues that we don't have direct authority over, we would defer to, like, for example, the fire department.
Or fire code problems.
Exactly. Plumbing. Or police, in case they're spilling.
I'm liking that.
Does your license require insurance?
It requires a workers' comp kind of insurance, not...
General liability.
So, I think we're making decisions on stuff that we're not qualified experts in, and I think that what I'd like to do is make a general suggestion that the city attorney work with County Public Health and as many of these items that can be covered by the county health requirements, defer to him to make that happen.
So, we've got the food handler license and then the operator training. So, those are a couple that absolutely we can defer to the expertise of public health.
What I'm saying is let's let it have a general permission that when he writes this ordinance, if it's, we don't need to be repetitive to what public health is requiring.
Message received.
I'm sorry?
Message received.
Okay.
Well, we've got to make sure they agree with me because otherwise bad things happen.
I assume that's the consensus, Mr. President.
Yes.
Okay.
Next one is restrictions, and that is essentially this addresses, this may be not necessary if we are talking about zones. This essentially says you can only serve if you're legally fully stopped.
I'm not chasing for a burger or whatever.
Somebody might. Hey, somebody wants that taco bad. You know?
No, I'm not chasing for it.
So, strike it, or is there no harm to leave it in there as a precautionary?
I leave it, I don't know.
I don't think it's going to hurt anything.
All right.
I'm definitely, let me tell the food trucks out there, I'm not chasing for food. I'm not that desperate.
Some of the rest of the next few are also public safety related. May only bend away from moving traffic. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Shall not stop on the left side of a one-way street to bend, Mr. Hickey.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think just from the discussions we've had prior to this, I think we're all leaning towards zones. So I think a lot of this would fall, be wrapped up neatly under zones. I mean, we're going to designate where they can vent from,
right,
and some of these other things are going to fall into place from that.
What about outside the central business district, though? I mean, are we concerned about, do we want to still have it in there for that?
I mean, that's primarily what this
well,
is covering,
right? For example, one of the suggested zones is to use the bus stops on 2nd Street during certain evening hours. These would still apply, I think. You don't want people serving to the street side. Right. So it kind of depends on the zone.
I mean, I think Councilmember Woljak's statement about, you know, separating the handling of the Central Business District from, you know, the rest of the city is probably an important step. If we just say, you know, we're setting these restrictions for zones inside of the CBD and have some more general rules of thumb for the rest of the city, I think that probably serves us better than trying to have just the zones and maybe square peg around.
Right. Well, I think we're getting a sense of what the text how it needs to read, given our desire to look at zones or idea of looking at zones. Some of these, again, straightforward, may not bend to a person standing in the roadway. Seems straightforward enough. Next one was annually must submit for approval to the city engineer the streets intended to be used for vending. I don't know if this is applicable given the discussion on zones.
I would say not,
because we're talking about potentially operating in residential areas, parks, etc. So I don't know that this is as appropriate as it maybe once was. So I'm suggesting striking it. Ms. Means?
May we ask the city engineer his opinion?
I'm sorry?
May we ask the city engineer his thoughts on this?
If you're designating zones, I assume that will be codified in some sort of a resolution or ordinance as far as what those zones are. Become part of probably the parking ordinance, and that would be okay. I mean, that's
good control. It won't be part of the parking ordinance, but it will be in the ordinance.
Okay.
Just note that the RDA has quite a bit of input on that one, so that have that be considered in that area too.
So, right there, they were talking about specific zones, which we reflected on the map, hopefully. So I'd come back to this may not be as appropriate since we are defining,
right.
Potentially defining zones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next one, may not vend in a single location longer than 15 minutes. Again, that might be no longer necessary, if we're talking about zones.
If we have zones, we can scratch that. It's necessary.
I just want to, are we exclusively, the guidelines that we're talking about now, we just want to be clear, we're exclusively talking downtown. We're not talking about the ice cream truck that goes through the neighborhoods. We're going to keep that like a separate ordinance?
There's a separate ordinance for that.
And then does the other ordinance then cover food trucks in the same way as we do the ice cream trucks?
We have two separate ordinances, two separate regulatory schemes.
Yeah, but it's not the type of truck, it's where it's at. There's the Central Business District one, and there's the rest of the city one.
I don't know.
Okay. I mean, ultimately, what I want to know is if a food truck can pull up to a city park.
And that's
a little bit later down on your list.
Yeah, they're later on the list.
But all these things that don't matter downtown, if we have zones, mm-hmm. It matters in that circumstance.
Agreed. All right. I'm just trying to push through the list so we at least get a sense of where we're at. I'm hearing that we're going to have perhaps some variation as we move through. Sound amplification, a limitation there to 500 feet.
I guess I'd be curious to Nick's comment of no amplification. That might make some sense if you've got a bunch of them together. Good.
I went through Nashville, and we were on the street, and you had multiple bars playing music at the same time, and it just got to be a racket. So I don't think this idea of having everyone with amplified sound fighting with each other is really going to, especially
right.
If we're doing zones.
If we're doing zones, it makes no sense.
And also, if we're going to open it up to be more liberal outside of the Central Business District, then again, it gets into this case of I really don't want to deal with complaints of some food trucks.
I guess I'd agree with that. So I think it makes some sense unless we hear otherwise.
I agree with Mr.
You can be as vocal as you want, as long as it's social media or something. It can't be through a megaphone.
It just catches me as the ice cream truck that runs around the community. You can hear way the hell further than 500 feet, half a mile away. So the one that's
my
running
kids would
around,
be really disappointed if I somehow figured out how to silence the ice cream truck. So I use that as an explanation when it's playing music without ice cream.
We'll see what the entrepreneurs have to say, but yeah. I'm guessing social media is going to be their tool of choice. Amplified sound.
Well, the ice cream truck is a different ordinance, right, Terry?
It is.
This is a different thing we're talking about here.
You're going to give us a rundown of that at some point. I'd like to understand the.
Well,
I'm
trying
diagram
to toggle between the two. The Chapter 143 regulates ice cream vendors, and what is it that you want to know?
Oh, so there's just 140. So there's ice cream vendors.
Yes, right. That's Chapter 143. We're in Chapter 143A.
I forgot that part.
There you go.
That's right.
It's unusual for me.
So I'm hearing no amplification.
So I'm striking that now?
That entire provision about no operator shall use a sound amplification device for more than 500 feet from the vehicle?
Are there food truck people here? Anyone that owns a food truck?
Yeah.
So you'll have an opportunity to yell at us about how that makes your business unviable between now and then. We're going to have a public hearing to hear this, but that amplification to me is about making the community comfortable with making the restrictions more liberal.
Minneapolis does not allow it.
Perfect. Then I'm right in line with Minneapolis.
What are we doing with Rochester Fest? There's not amplification there, is there? With any of the vendors all the way up and down?
Really created a can of worms if there was.
There's the one for the stage, obviously, but the rest of it's a lot of them.
But it goes to Mr. Ruskus.
So a lot of them have music playing.
If we have a zone and you have all these vehicles together,
that's it.
Amplification isn't going to help them any.
And Nashville would be upset if you called that noise.
Well, I don't. It's beautiful music.
I was going to say it is a pretty successful area, too.
It's beautiful noise.
How dare I use them?
Neil Diamond says it's beautiful noise. So
am I striking that?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. And one thought that I should have started with, actually, and I realize I'm pushing us through this, and I don't want to gloss over public safety or significant policy issues, but one caveat I would put out there is just let's not let perfect get in the way of good enough. We've got a distinct urgency to want to try this for a season, so we will very much have another opportunity at the end of the season and before the next one to get some feedback on what worked and didn't. So that's why I'm not perhaps getting hung up on every dotted I. The next one is identification tag. That would be part of the permit issued by the... do they get a tag, or do they just have to post the license or permit?
Never had to issue one, so... Just probably provide them some sort of license to post, like you do for liquor licenses.
Some printed
like that.
Thing that they post in the food truck.
Question. I'm curious what the county does. Is that what you do?
Yeah, we issue a license. It's a paper license.
And it has to be posted.
It has to be posted.
Okay. So we would do something similar. All right. Next one is a public safety item again. You may not back the vehicle up in an attempt to make a sale.
Can I just go back to that last one? It says issued by the city clerk, but we're kind of talking about it could be issued by the public health department. So
I heard the gentleman state that they require that to be posted.
Right. And that's
so I'm not going to duplicate that requirement, but if you want to require the city clerk either a license or a tag to be posted in addition, then I will keep that provision in.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of wondering which one are we doing? Are we doing both then?
Yes, because they're two separate licenses.
So then we're just adding public health.
Yep.
All right, good enough.
Okay. Vehicle may not be backed up in an attempt to make a sale. Seems to be a straightforward public safety item.
Yeah, I won't chase them, but they can back up to me. It's fine.
Okay.
I'm not opposed to that to get fat, but I'm not chasing.
Let's tackle the hours of operation. Looks like we've got a variety of opinions there. Currently, the ordinance says that there's no vending between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. the following day. Based on this thinking that we might go to zones, that's why my thought was no vending allowed between 1 a.m. and 7 a.m. But as you can see, we've got some choices.
I guess I would be unwilling to commit until I've heard from the entrepreneurs in terms of where they think the market is at, particularly in the downtown core.
Mr. Hickey.
I mean, I think that's what we said. We're going to come up with a draft ordinance, then we'll have people comment on it and perhaps make changes.
Mr. Russell.
Well, the reason I put what I did is I guess I'm kind of wondering why we would have recommendations. There might be some niches out there that people find. The late night crowd, something of that nature. Unless the Rochester Police Department has an issue with it, I'm kind of wondering why we would say it have to be done at midnight. You know, if they want to be open till 1 because they know they're going to get extra business, then
our business at 2.
Right. That's kind of why I put. I guess I'd be open to hearing why we have to have certain hours. I understand the transportation ones and that during the rush hour, but. Other than that, what would be the reason to have it limited to midnight or whatever? So,
and I'm not wedded to any particular set of hours. If you want to leave it open-ended and let the police department chime in, I'm okay with that. All right.
So what am I doing?
No hours.
Yeah. As kind of articulated by Mr. Ruska's comment. Locations. I don't know if you want to tackle that now or in a minute, because the map that was attached shows some possible zones. What would you like to do?
Well, I have a number of concerns with that, so let's just come back to it and get through the easy ones.
Let's return to that one. You may vend on private property with permission. That seems to be still in standing, correct?
Right. We can't control that.
I wouldn't want to.
No, but Mr. Atkins says he doesn't know if we can require permits.
I'll look to see whether or not you can extend your licensure to that activity that occurs on private property, unless you tell me you have no desire to do so, even if you can.
I think we should.
Okay.
I don't necessarily have desire to do that. I mean, that's my personal preference. If it's private property and they want to put up a food truck, that's
it. I'm with Nick.
Can I ask the Homestead County gentleman, do you license? Do we have people who do just that?
Yes.
And do you issue licenses to them?
We do.
You don't treat them any differently from people? In other words, your licensure status doesn't depend upon where it is they're doing their vending?
To some degree, we want to make sure that if they're on private property, we review is it, zoning. There's a zoning issue that we can check on. It's very brief. It's kind of out of our realm, really. We just want to make sure, because if they operate there for more than 21 days, there is some wording in statute that talks about jurisdiction. So
okay.
We want to make sure that we do some due diligence there.
So where did that leave us? You seem to have a thought, Mr. Atkins.
Well, as long as they're being inspected and licensed by a public entity, private or public, I'm not sure what you gain by extending any regulation. Other than the franchise fee wouldn't work because they're not using city street.
Right.
So all you'd be doing is requiring a city license to vend no matter where they're at. Let me look to see what I can find on that subject.
Okay. All right. Residential, currently not addressed in our ordinance. You see some of the comments there. Some indicated only during certain events, such as National Night Out. Events only, or do you want it more open-ended? What's the thinking there?
I have no problem. I mean, my whole concern is that we figure out how to make it safe for the downtown area. If they choose to go elsewhere, at this point, I don't have an issue.
No, so no real guardrails there.
No.
I keep some of the other safety type things in there, but I think there'd be a lot of times where food trucks would pull up to some of the parks, which are in residential areas when things are going on, and provide options there. So I think that I would, like to see them have the ability to do that.
I can actually see that as a huge public benefit when a neighborhood wants to plan a night out in their park and show a movie or whatever. Being able to have a food truck pull up is a pretty big positive.
Mr. Ruska?
I guess since we asked for the RDA and CDB's input, they do have a little different position. They're both in agreement on this, and so just know what they've got in there. Basically, I think they're just looking for written permission, which, Nick, your point is good. If it's something that people want them to pull up and be part of their event, they can easily do that. Then it's just a little bit more, everybody's aware of it. So.
Yeah. For me, I guess I'm starting to be brought around an argument that says it's not going to be economical to spend in a cul-de-sac. You're not going to set up a food vending in a cul-de-sac. They're going to be looking for high traffic areas, and that those areas are typically more noisy. So I think a lot of this probably doesn't need to be regulated is the bigger part of this. And if it does, I'd be happy to come back to the cow and fix it then. But on the residential stuff, I just don't see it even needing to be addressed, really. I don't see most of these things becoming significant.
If I hear you right, and I would agree with you, that essentially, if you want to vend in a residential area, go for it.
Until it becomes a problem, I'd say we'll be a little bit reactive here. If it becomes a problem, then we'll choose to be a little bit more legislative about it. But right now, I just
Mr. Nickburn?
You may want to come back to this item with parks, but I can see where a a vendor may just decide to pull up in front of a park that's having a, an event activity going on that we authorize in the park department, with a soccer game or a marathon or a community event, just saying, hey, it's a public tree, they can pull up and start taking over and get this free captive audience for their activity without having the vendors at the event that are paid for the event activities benefiting from that.
That's a good point.
So, yeah. May vend in residential areas or parks, but need permission if there's a planned event.
Right, that's where the RDA and RCVB, that's exactly what they hit on, is just making sure that if it's special events or private events, that people are aware of it or authorize it.
And I do think there are other places that there's going to be a lot of desire for food trucks to operate. The St. Mary's area has a higher employment density than most of downtown. And as such, you know, that's pretty much all residential area surrounding it. So, you know, I wouldn't want to deny the opportunity for food trucks to, you know, work in that area either.
Yeah, we're going to have to get there early if we're going to get parking. But, yeah, I mean, I agree with that.
So I could agree with the language as proposed, or the sentiment as proposed by RDA,
which is...
No vending in residential areas unless advanced written permission on private property or special events.
Can we make it just parks instead of all residential areas? I mean, I can certainly sympathize with the idea that you put up a private event and you don't want these trucks, but I would hate to legislate something really broad for what's hopefully like a 0.1% case of, you know, actual usage of a food truck. If you have Cutsey Park neighborhood or you have a Slatterly Park neighborhood and they want to have a food truck come in, you know, we're going to hear about it right away if it's a problem. I guarantee it. I'll have voicemails. We'll be able to come back and fix this relatively quickly and adopt this language. I just would rather wait for it to be a problem than to be too off in front of this and maybe let some business that wouldn't develop otherwise develop.
Yeah,
I guess I'm worried about changing the rules, though, after people have already told them that this is okay, and then they invest in it. Now you're going to say, oh, we're going to quick change this on you because it's an issue. So, you know, I guess I'm kind of wondering what would be wrong with what he's asking here, because like Mike says, if you've got events going on and somebody rolls in and somebody's planning on part of the fundraiser is concessions or sale of food or something, and they've got permission and got permits and they set it up, somebody comes in and takes away from them, we're going to have issues with that.
I do understand that, but I'm thinking of like Watson Field where there's soccer games every Sunday. You know, it's a vendor that has a permit may be right up in the parking lot or down on the field. I don't remember exactly where they set up. But versus someone that's going to park over on 41st Street and serve on that end is, you know, I don't know. Is that competition a bad thing? Is getting more options out there for people to use a bad thing? Is that, you know, I don't know. I'm not necessarily right away that having, you know, purchasing a vendor gives you exclusive rights to all the people that are at those soccer games. I don't know that that's ever been, has that been codified in one of these?
Actually, when we've been in our parks, and like with soccer, they have concession rights for the soccer fields while they're doing their activities.
I don't know. We're not allowing them to operate in the park. We're allowing them to sit in the street and serve in a public area. You know, I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit wishy-washy.
What if it's not a big deal and they should sign off on it?
Who's the authority figure in that case? Or who's the authority?
You say that people would have it reserved and have a
soccer, for example, we have soccer concessions on that soccer day. And if they say, yeah, go for it, bed, they can go to bed.
So
they've been invited to participate.
In the Minneapolis ordinance, there is a when there's an event, there's a buffer that they cannot operate in without written permission. Why don't we just do that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can come around to that.
So we're asking to look at the Minneapolis ordinance in terms of the operation in residential area. All right.
500 feet. Special events only, or is that all? That doesn't cover all residential areas, right?
Special events or athletic facilities.
Okay. I would be comfortable with that.
All right. Okay.
God bless Minneapolis for doing the hard work for us, right?
Next one is may not vend in the central business district. Of course, we are talking about using zones to allow for permitted activity. So, we'll probably need some appropriate legal language for that. May not vend in the central business district, except for these defined zones and hours.
Except for, or are you? Is your zone approach going to take care of this entirely? If you're breaking everything up into a zone, why do you need this?
Right.
I think that's his point.
May not.
Right. That was your point, right?
No, I didn't hear that. I heard, well, unless it's otherwise regulated by a zone.
Yeah, what you're saying is simpler. It just says we define zones and...
Have at it.
Here's where you miss.
Okay. All right. Okay, buffer for food trucks and similar food businesses. Here again, we had a range of opinions, anywhere from 100 feet to no buffers.
If we have zones, again, why do you need to worry about the buffers?
That could very well be the case.
Well, and that would be, again, it would apply to places outside of the central business district where, again, you don't want somebody's food truck pulling up. You don't want the taco place pulling up in front
of
a Mexican restaurant.
For example, Southeast Marion Road, could you have a food truck in the, close to the Burger King, for example?
Those ones are on private property too, I think. But the National League of Cities, their best practice in their document was 100 feet from 100 feet from the from street access to other restaurants, and that's what I support.
So is that private? Does it matter if it's private or public? I mean, you made it sound, Michael, like if it's private, it doesn't matter if it's 150 feet or whatever. But I mean, could somebody set one up on their own private property right next to a restaurant, saying it's our property, so too bad?
I think so, because ultimately they could probably build a restaurant there, right, and serve the same. I mean, there's nothing that would prohibit them from servicing that same clientele. I just really, the private property, if you buy the property, in my mind, you can put a truck on it. You can set up a grill there, too, if you want, I guess. I don't know. But.
So, where are you at on this? Buffer or no buffer?
I'm fine with the buffer.
100 feet sounds good.
No, and I think that's some language they tend to typically spell out as it's 100 feet from the entrance, from a street level entrance to a restaurant place, and where that comes into play is if you have food courts or something that don't actually have street access. That's not what they're going after.
That's fine.
All right. So we're going to use 100-foot buffer, similar to what Minneapolis ordinance has done. Again.
Well, I believe you mentioned it was some National League of Cities.
This was in the National League of Cities. They have that policy briefing on food truck policy.
100 feet from established restaurant entrances with street access.
That's significantly different than what the RDA and the CBB have recommended. So,
what I got to go back and forth between
500.
That's what
they're recommending.
That's not
unless in designated zones.
Yeah.
Wiggle room to it, but
again, I think we'll hear some comments during the public hearing, whether that's going to be acceptable or not.
I think so.
100's a little close for me.
Would you want 500?
Well, I got 150 on here, but
I could live with 150.
I could live with 150.
All right,
150 it is.
150.
There's We don't do public comment in this meeting.
It was a question. Yeah. Now, you stated that you were referring to Minneapolis ordinances. What is your ordinance?
We're just suggesting that we can, if we're trying to come up with language, we could actually refer to their ordinance and see if that would work for us, just to give us a starting point for some potential language, and then we'll see if that meets our need. Food preparation, I think we had said...
Well, I just maybe reiterate that we will, after we get this drafted up, there will be a public hearing and people will be able to come in and share their thoughts. None of these things are going to be in stone until we have the public hearing. So keep that in mind. If you're not happy with some of these things, you'll have a chance to be heard. We don't want to stifle people from sharing, but there'll be that time.
Yeah. All right. The next one is food preparation on site, and I think we were in agreement that that would be permissible.
Question for the OCPH gentleman, is that addressed by you?
Yeah, in fact, we license the mobile units so that they can prepare food.
So why do we have to address it
in the unit? They need to prepare it somewhere where
Since that's addressed by the county health department, I don't think there's any need for it.
Here.
If you're still sticking with your avoid redundancy whenever possible
Fine
direction.
Okay. All right, utilities. Here we were suggesting that any food truck needs to provide their own utilities, water, electricity, et cetera, no cords or hoses. What do you think? That's not currently in our ordinance.
Has the county health department addressed that?
Yeah, I mean, it, general language, the food stores improve, you know, wastewater dumping, that kind of thing, but it may be beneficial, maybe not to have in coding or codes, but to have guidance on where to dump their wastewater, so that we make sure that the vendors go to a certain spot that the city wants to direct them to a spot that they know is secure and safe and accessible.
Public Works.
Yeah, that's the dumping station.
Yeah. You have a strong opinion about where they should go with the wastewater, right?
Yes.
Perfect.
The Public Works Director.
Dumping station. Into the waste treatment facility.
Yeah. But I see a number of comments with no cords or hoses. Is that addressed by the county?
I don't think so. I mean, we look at the operation food prep inside the unit. We could say something. There are enough safety, general safety provisions. If there's a problem, we make an issue.
You may want to address that if that's a strongly held opinion, because it doesn't sound like a paramount concern for the health department.
I would also be interested in taking, as this progresses, some cities actually create systems of hookups in frequently used locations to avoid the, you know, generators running, that sort of thing. And I don't know if it necessarily even has to be addressed at this point, because we're not that mature as a, you know, food truck city yet. But it's something that there may be times where you do want them hooking up.
Yeah, and I think that's future. I think it's pretty unanimous here. No cords, no hoses, and you must provide your own water and electricity. And I would just also add that you must go to dispose of waste at the place that we indicate.
Okay. Gets us a starting point.
Oh, sorry, next one, yeah. Next one's waste.
Yeah, waste. Here I was talking more about solid waste when I made my comment. Waste created during the creating of the food or serving and so forth. The vendor is responsible for their own waste. I didn't think it would be realistic to say that they're responsible for the consumer waste, because those would be, well, you don't know where it'll actually be disposed, in park containers or canisters on the boulevard and so forth. Mr. Bildebeck.
I was just going to ask Public Health if they have any comments on waste from the vehicle or from the preparation of food and things of that nature. Is that covered in Public Health?
Yeah, we would have that discussion with them, with what's in their unit. But I do think it would be proactive for the city to think about the solid waste that's being carried away from the mobile units. And because when we work with an event, for instance, say, let's say with county, the coordinator there will make sure there's enough, you know, garbage dumpsters or garbage cans, that kind of thing. Because once they walk away from the stand, you don't know where it's going. So that's something to consider.
So that would be receptacles for the zone or what have you. But you take care of the waste from the vehicle that's produced by the food truck.
Yep, that's part of their operation, their business. So.
Okay.
So I don't know, again, if it's part of the public health piece, I don't know why we'd be involved in redundancy.
Well, what I heard was, if you want to do anything, do something in the area of adequate receptacles.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the responsibility of the food vendor or the city?
If we set up the zones, I really think it's probably our response.
Mr. Freeze?
I think I would just ask that as you set the permit fee, you consider the cost of additional receptacles that the city will need to purchase and the cost of emptying those more frequently.
Yeah.
In your designated zone. So it's a legitimate expense that you could include as part of the fee. Can't tell you what that would be, but I think it's just right. Something you should consider.
So we can figure out the cost, but I just think it makes sense to provide the receptacles, otherwise you're asking for, you know, a trash problem.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the mayor will finally get his solar compactors.
There you go.
All right.
I don't think they're big enough for that.
Well, Moving on here, these are items that Mr. Bildebeck, I know, mentioned, parking meters. And I suppose depending on what we talk about with the fee, this could be addressed there. Because the parking meters, the gist of that discussion was that they provide revenue to the city and that the city should at least break even on the lost revenue. So anyway, this item enters the discussion. Do you expect them to plug meters while they're sitting in the zone, or is the fee meant to cover the potential lost revenue? Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, I would think if we had zones, I would think we'd bag the meters and we'd figure a way to cover that through the fee.
Okay.
And the one comment I would have, I know some of these potential fees were just put out there for discussion, but the one based on meters kind of assumed an entire full season. Are there ways to break that down, a smaller bite if a vendor maybe has a shorter season or something like that?
The bagging the meters is, depending on where the trucks are, is either important or not important at all, because some of these are streets that aren't utilized for anything important during the day.
So what do you want to do?
I don't really want them interacting with the meter, would be my personal preference, because we're charging a fee. I mean, the goal is that the fee cost, and we're going to have
much simpler.
And if we're going to be doing improvements to the area, like trash receptacles, and they probably need places to sit possibly, or whatever we're going to do, we're going to want to make sure that we put it all in one fee. I don't want people to have to be plugging meters, and it costs us money to go out and service them, and I just think it's better to, I said that we'll remove them, but we might have to figure out how we control traffic otherwise. I mean, maybe the food truck permit left people into a special zone, and we handle it that way that we have.
So this line item was inserted by us because it's not addressed in our current ordinance, and we didn't know if we were going down zones or not, down that path. Assuming we use zones and some sort of fee structure, you could strike this whole line item.
Yes, I agree.
Same thing for diagonal parking.
If we do zones, I have a real issue when you talk about safety and diagonal parking and the fact that many of the food trucks are longer than what our parking is on diagonal, and then you got issues on left side, right side. So I would have a real issue. But if we do zones, I'm willing to strike that as well.
Technically, too, if you are doing the diagonal parking, you are serving on the roadway.
Right.
Which comes into conflict from something earlier. I mean, I think there's ways to work that out. Mr. Hickey brought up the point about ways of breaking up the fees in terms of into smaller bites. And I think the other thing that I'm hearing is that, do we want to have for somebody who gets one of these fees, do we want to have a minimum number of days of operation standard to make sure that they're these things are being used as intended and aren't just cherry picking a couple events here and there.
And that's something I would really want to hear from the vendors, the food truck folks themselves. They know kind of how this is working and not working, and they're going to have some idea whether they want somebody out there for 6 weeks or 2 weeks versus when they're out there for the summer trying to make it. So I'd be interested in hearing from the food vendors on that.
Okay. All right. So we'll leave that kind of on the zone discussion. Movement.
Am I striking parking meters and diagonal parking?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Movement, and that is, again, we're assuming that we're using zones, but there are certain times of the day that we potentially don't want vehicles, moving around or, maybe jockeying for a position and so forth. Again, I'm open on this one. We didn't want them, what I suggested is we not have vehicles moving around between 7 and 9 a.m. and 4 and 5:30 p.m. during kind of the rush hour, but I'm open. If you don't think that's important.
I don't think it makes a difference.
Okay. I'm okay with striking it.
I'm all for straight.
Okay.
I'm guessing they're going to self-select when they want to move anyway.
Well, I think this whole thing of parking and how it's going to be handled in its own is a big issue.
Okay.
I've got it all figured out.
So that really brings us to the two key discussion items of, do you want to go down that zone path? Seemed to be the preference. And then there were some suggested zones in the Central Business District to kind of get us started. and then we have the fee discussion. What on the map, there were a number of logical choices presented. Reaction to that, to limited, seemed like a good spot to start. What were your thoughts on that?
I guess I am hesitant to put zones in place before we really know where the market is for this. Obviously we want to listen closely to what they say at the public hearing, but depending on what the fee is, it's going to drive how close they need to be to where the action is. And I think some of these zones are just not viable zones. I've heard a lot of people with a lot of different interests in where they want to be, but I guess I'd be of the preference that the food truck operator should help us understand where, in fact, this is viable. I love the idea of using space that's essentially wasted space during the day. The Second Avenue is one of them that's ultimately dead space during the day, just south of the Mayo Building.
That's
one of them in there. But a lot of these that are further out are, challenging. I know there's some interest. I've heard some from some folks that want on the south end of town, but I really have a hard time dictating this decision other than to say, we probably wouldn't want to put them where there's going to be significant conflict during the day.
And I guess my feeling is, to start the conversation, yeah. I'm not opposed to the zones at this point, just to start the conversation. Again, nothing has been written in stone, but we can hear. I'm sure they will let us know if they think that's fair or not fair. And their opinion, but I think we need to have a starting point.
I think that's fair, and I guess that my comment would be, As far as the zones go, I'm okay with or without them, but ultimately I don't have any strong opinion until I hear from the entrepreneurs.
Yeah. And I'm just saying it's a starting point.
Okay. Mr. Campion.
So I take it as a step along the path, and I think now it's clear that we probably need to delineate between the Central Business District and the rest of the city. And Kelly Corbin sent out a snippet from the Minneapolis kind of license application that has this letter of consent idea, which I actually am coming to like based on our discussion. The idea is basically if you're operating within 200 feet of certain businesses, you have to get a letter of consent from them that says you can operate here. So it's kind of a way of both wrapping the buffer and an exception process into one. Maybe we let that rule the city outside of the Central Business District, and we set up these zones principally to cover the Central Business District until we're comfortable that maybe this thing is working, maybe we don't need to be so restrictive, maybe we open it up a little bit more. But I really see this as a little bit of an iterative process here where we're going to come up with hopefully two different, there are different sets, there are different needs, there are different expectations of the different areas. And then we, iterate on it a little bit. So for that reason, the zone process for me is a good place to start. Make people feel comfortable that, these are how these businesses operate, get people used to them, and then maybe we start looking more. So I'm generally in support of that. I think outside of the Central Business District, we should be pretty flexible. We should let them look for spots that are maybe we are not going to find. Let people find something that's going to work for their business, and then maybe eventually we can start revisiting for the Central Business District.
I agree that it's a starting point, and we'll learn from the experience. These seem to be locations that were in the Central Business District, other than Soldier Field, of course, that would be a good starting point. And I was intrigued by the idea, for example, of even using Second Street for limited nighttime hours. That was kind of intriguing. Normally, I wouldn't have supported Second Street Southwest, but I think RCVB suggested between 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. to catch some of that late night traffic, food traffic, and I'm okay with that. Mr. Ruska?
If it really fits in the zones, but I don't remember the exact conversation, but I'd like the park department to weigh in a little bit on parks. Maybe the park board, since they oversee the parks, is to give us a memo or a thought on how they see this too. So.
You want to pass, we sure get that for you. I think the gut reaction we've got right now is Central Park and Soldiers Field Park. If they come back before our board, we've got a vending process already in place that they can sure vend in our parks under those activities. Central Park is more unique where it's public right-of-way all the way around it. But what they do in that right of way would sure impact the park pretty dramatically, both from an event standpoint as well as just a general vending on a day by day basis. But that being said, the hours of operation in that particular park may cause some problems also. If our parks close at dusk, if you're going to allow vending in the right of way until 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, they'll be hanging out the park at that location as well. So those concerns that we've got, that we can sure address more.
Has the park board had any discussions at all on it?
We've not, no.
I guess I'd like to get some, you know, maybe some feedback from them as far as all the parks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, again, for discussion purposes, we can put this forward as possible zones and see where it goes. If these are too restrictive or not the right locations, we'll hear about it. Okay. Fees. What do you want to do with fees?
Significantly less than $1,500. I mean, my standpoint is Minneapolis is at 818, and there's more density, more opportunity up there. I think more in that, you know, proportionally more in the $600 range would be put us on more of a level footing with them.
By chance, it's not used for the park, $600.
$600? You are a genius.
So I am trying to lump a couple concepts together here, because this minimum serving concept, I think, is Councilmember Hickey was sitting on. So I was wondering if maybe we wanted to do maybe a month or 2 month segment where they have to buy, or how we would do that. If there's ones that are more seasonal that aren't going to operate for the average 6 months a year, are we going to have a way that they, or do they just buy the full license?
Yeah, the modeling that I did, I just made some assumptions that they could operate from beginning of April through the end of September, I think. I didn't overthink it.
Yeah.
And I didn't think about whether there would be a minimum number of days of operation. I just said, here's your opportunity, your window of opportunity. That's how I calculated the fee. I did not say that you couldn't operate in March, for example, or, you know, if we get a really beautiful October. I was just trying to come up with a way to calculate the annual fee.
Was it based on 7 days a week or 5 days a week?
Oh.
Remember how you came up with that?
5 days. I think I used a 5 day a week for the meter, 5 days a week, and we projected 85% utilization of the meters. So we just kind of ground through it that way. Property tax model was just based on per square foot property tax using two benchmarks. Or restaurants. So I don't pretend that this was rocket science. It was just a place to start. I'm open to where you'd like to.
Yeah, I was thinking I was starting to get settle around the number of like $100 to $125 a month, which would come out. I mean, I was at $750, but. Something around there where, and if we allowed them to buy in 2 month segments. Where if you're going to continue operating, we have a nice October, you're buying two more months to serve, even if you only do 1 month or something like that, to kind of convince people that if you're going to get in this game, you're going to get into it for 60 days. And you pay once a year, but you, I don't know, I'm making it too complicated.
Yeah.
Let's just make it 7 months.
Yeah, I didn't want to overthink it, because I'm sure everyone, I heard ranges everywhere from $150 to $10,000.
Oh, you only went up to $10,000, I heard $16,000.
I mean, it was really all over the map. So I just tried to come up with something that I could at least base it on some quantifiable information. Mr. Russell.
I guess I'd like some input from Public Works on the pubs, you know, the meters and stuff, if we're going to give some of that space up, what that would mean to recover the reasonable amount back. And you know, I guess I'm I don't know what Nick was referring to with the $16,000, but I've heard from businesses that are paying $17,000-$18,000 a month to run their restaurants. And so with that, I want us to be just a reasonable fee here, and you know, certainly whatever else is out of pocket cost to be covered. So I didn't think the $1,500 was too much.
And the property tax model, that's where we used two restaurants and we based it on what they were paying annually or a month. And that's how we ultimately arrived at the paying.
And you did 12 months, right, for that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which two restaurants?
I'm sorry?
Which two restaurants did you use?
Dooley's and Newt's.
Dooley's and Newt's. Okay. And Okay, so you were condoed out. You just condoed out the restaurant portion of that then, or?
Well, good point, because there's some space that's adjunct space, restroom, space, and so forth. Just, I think we just
used... took the space as identified in the county's property tax records.
That's probably the total square footage.
And looked at what the taxes were and divided it out and calculated per square foot.
Is that the amount that's at $1,100 per year?
Yes.
The franchise fee.
For the franchise fee.
Right, not the licensing fee.
I'm wondering if that's even high. For some of our food truck vendors to maybe just starting out. I'd probably like to see it reduced, maybe an even 1,000 or 900. Couple hundred dollars.
Again, I'm completely open. I just wanted to give us a starting point.
The other part too. My understanding is, we're looking, and maybe your Mr. Villas' comments confused me a little bit. But are we looking for a single fee for a season?
Ideally.
I mean, that's. I think what one of the ordinances I saw. You buy a permit, it just expires April 1st of each year. So basically, you've got to get a new one going into the new season. But we're not, I don't want to get into a situation where we have different fees for different service levels. And that they'd be a little bit concerned.
I think that gets really complicated when you start to.
Is that just for the CBD again? Are we talking about other vendors outside? Because I mean, we also at one point had a discussion about vendors outside the CBD paying a different fee because they don't have access to all the same spots. I don't know. Are we not going to delineate anymore? Okay.
How much?
Then I'll throw it in there. I guess I would say we do something like, let's just throw a meter out there. You know, if we're going to say $818 is what Minneapolis does, I think $800 for Rochester, and we say that if you're going to be outside the CBD, we have a different price. I think a distinction between those two is okay in my mind. And maybe we say that external one would be half that. And allow you to operate outside the CBD. And then we see. I would just assume bring this back after we give it a year to test drive and fix it again. I know we're going to try and do the perfect thing first, because we always do, but I think this is going to be something we're trying to be flexible on.
Yeah. Mr. Fried?
Well, from the parking revenue perspective, we have to figure about $7 a day per meter. So if you're a truck parked parallel to the curb, it would probably take at least 5 meters.
Well, these are the numbers that Tony Canower provided.
So that's $1,550 a month. That's $900 for 6 months.
That's for 1 meter.
That's for one space.
One space, yeah, right.
It should be noted, too, that Minneapolis, with their year on fees, they do require them to plug meters if they use a meter space. They do have to maintain the meters.
In addition to the fee.
So they're about double then.
That would be double.
Well, if they're using metered spaces.
If they're
spaces.
Using metered space, they have to just plug
and,
the meters.
You know, some of these areas
they're not allowed to plug into.
That would be surcharge for the CBD, then. I mean, that would be the difference between operating downtown.
Yeah, I think that might be a good way of doing it.
Does that seem reasonable? Maybe we make it $800 globally, and then we say it's $1,600, or it's another $800 to be downtown, and we're going to take the parking. So it's $1,600 downtown.
If that's a reasonable starting point, I'd just...
I'd like to get some stuff out there so people can come back and tell us that's not going to fit any food truck or it's going to be great.
I would like
sure, I'm going to hear a lot of it's going to be great emails.
I would like it combined. So if it needs to include both of them, then maybe the fee has to be a little bit larger.
So once again, Mr. Campion is saying $800 is the fee regardless, but if you're in the CBD, it's an additional $800? Where there are metered spots.
We set it to $1,500. It seemed like everyone was pretty happy with the $1,500 number. We make that. I think we got to get a number out there so people can tell us how long we are.
All right. This is a licensing fee. Yes? Yes.
Or is this the franchise
fee? This is the franchise fee. Correct.
I'm asking.
Right. It's a combination of both.
No. Have to be broken out.
Okay. Well,
the licensing fee, there we do have a restriction. We can only recover costs.
Right.
So we got to get the costs right? You're going to tell us how much it's going to be.
Or we can roll it as a franchise fee. No, because especially if we have people who are doing this on private property, we can't charge them a franchise fee. Okay. But you may end up licensing them. So they're too big, should be two different fees. Licensing, to get the license, you're restricted to the cost of administration work, enforcement, and then the franchise fee, which reflects your use of the city rights-of-way to conduct your business, similar to cable TV or electric or other utilities.
You know, the whole idea of assuming that they have to pay for meter usage works if they're using metered spots, but if they're...
In a zone, it's metered.
Well, but some of the zones aren't metered right now.
The ones outside Hilton are not metered. That's for the city bus.
So, I mean, we're costing a zero revenue in those locations.
Okay. And that's not metered on the west side of the street, I believe. That's not metered.
So, you know, the Minneapolis approach of if they're using meter spots, let them plug the meter, does make it a lot simpler for us.
So we could go with a model that says it's $800, period, and if you happen to be in a meter spot, you plug the meter.
I don't like that.
I don't like that.
You don't like that?
No.
All right.
What do you think, Richard?
It's the easiest.
It may be the
easiest for everyone. We're not going to go out there every day and bag meters. I mean, that's
no.
Impossible to do that because we don't know where the trucks are going to be.
Well, if we do the zones, we know. Well, in the zone, the CBD,
we're not going to put a meter up if there's no or bag on a meter if there's nobody sitting in that space.
I know. We'll dig the meter out.
Good point.
I think that I like to normally make staff's life more difficult. In this case, I'd like to maybe make it easier. Acknowledge. Thank you.
So where are we at as a starting point?
Okay. I think that's a reasonable concession that they have to plug the meters if they're operating in a metered spot. And then if we get feedback from them that's completely untenable, we bring it back and we figure out another solution. That we can enact that one very quickly. The idea of sending Richard out to dig up meters or to bag and
Richard's
have that figured out.
Do you really think Richard's going to delegate something?
Yeah, I think he would.
Depends on if it's a nice summer day.
So, all right. Mr. Camping, your proposal was 800, and then they plug the meters if they're in the downtown.
But I have to review. I have to get my language precise for the city attorney. There's a fee. I'm just looking to try and match what the city. Let's follow Minneapolis on that.
Because it sounds like that's what they do
on the licensing.
Yes. Yeah. Make sure that we're operating in accordance with their suggestion.
What was their line again?
I'm okay with that. Just start.
Yeah, I think it's a great starting point. Yeah. It's a starting point. That's what this whole thing is right
Where's
now.
Where's the dollar point?
Getting some feedback that looks like I'm making a critical exception.
Since public health left the room, is that $800 inclusive of the public health fee?
No.
Or is
no,
it
no.
On top of. Okay. Perfect.
And that's consistent with the other communities as well. The fees were cumulative. Okay.
So if they haven't plugged the meters, are they going to get a ticket?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to go around and check them then.
Until they start writing.
We do that already.
Enforcement out. So that would continue.
Yes, we do.
I don't think that would be any different. And, you know, to note, the Minneapolis ordinance also does require them to follow all meter regulations. So if it's a meter that says, you know, short-term only and you have to move on, then that's what they have to follow. There's no exemptions. Basically, it's going to follow whatever that area is.
But we wouldn't be doing that. I mean, if it's a 30-minute meter, you're not going to make them move after 30 minutes.
Well, they have to be within a zone. So
Right.
Can you review it and see what the zone is like and come back and tell us? Because I don't have this committed to memory, all the parking regulations inside those zones. So I'd like to see that and staff will figure that so we can be sure we're doing the right thing.
What does Murphy pay on the Peace Plaza for his hot dog stand every day? Mm-hmm.
That was three.
His annual fee is roughly $300.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's governed by a different ordinance.
Yeah, right.
Well, and I imagine there'll be some comments versus, food carts versus food trucks, too, and, making sure they're getting equivalent treatment. So.
Did we make it through all the items we had to cover?
We did.
Can I just add one more that, again, on this the Minneapolis review, they do require a certificate of liability insurance, and that could be another thing we want to make sure. It sounded like there was no certification at the county level for that.
I think we still have that.
Oh, was that in there?
It specifies it. It said insurance. That was one of the first things. But I don't know if
insurance
in our ordinance,
required,
if it specifies what kind of insurance.
They have plenty.
What, and you're looking at what again?
I have this document. It looks like an application for a mobile food vehicle vendor.
From Minneapolis?
Yeah, and nice. Item 8 on it is a certificate of liability insurance, which requires up to $1 million per occurrence.
Right, but the certificate's the magic word. That's a document that's used to show proof of insurance coverage. It's what I require.
Okay.
When people are required to provide insurance for city contracts.
I just want to make
I'll
sure
just
that
carry that forward.
Perfect. I just want to make sure we have that in the language.
Okay. So the next step then, and I realize we're putting a little pressure on the city attorney's office to, as soon as you can codify this in some draft form, then we would be prepared to hold a public hearing. Is that correct?
What do you think that would be, Mr. City Attorney?
Well, Mr. Staber wants an April 4th public hearing, and that's my goal.
Yes, Ms. Mean.
This is really aggressive, I think, because we think we've been here about an hour and a half just with this discussion.
I know.
We can anticipate about that much discussion at the public hearing.
Easy, yeah.
And I wonder, is there any way that we could perhaps get that feedback earlier from some of the vendors and some of the neighbors, you know, by using our neighbors list or whatever?
Well,
because some of them may be similar, they could be grouped together to expedite the process if we had to come to everybody's desire.
Right. I'm open to timeline. I'm just sensitive to the clock ticking in the
we
month.
We can't do it any faster. Or
no.
That was kind of the. So the. I think we'll be getting feedback immediately. Mm-hmm. And portend that as soon as we get
out. I'm already getting feedback.
And I would anticipate the April 4th would be the night of the public hearings.
But I would like to push for April 4th, too, because it's important that we have it ready for this season.
Mm-hmm. And that feedback should come to the council members as well.
Yeah.
And as well as the administration, if that's their choice.
I think, Ms. Means, you're absolutely correct. Any feedback that we get individually, we should forward to Mr. Quimbo and ask him to send that to all council members.
Or we could just ask them to send it to
Mr.
Quimbo directly.
Yeah, that works.
You better check with Lisa. She'll be the one that's collecting them all.
Yeah. All right. We'll cover that topic for today then. We have two others and we're pressed for time here. Mr. Freeze, you want to go through this one?
So, if you recall, if you recall during the budget process, you authorized a position, a new position in the Public Works Department of Administrative Assistant to work in the Administrative Division, but you did not fund it. And basically, you instructed us to come back to you after the first of the year with a proposal for what fees could be that you could consider to fund the position. The position itself won't work in the Land Development Division. I just want to make that clear. The proposed fees cover existing staff within the Land Development position, but then provide enough revenue to offset the new request. So, so I sent you information and wanted to, because you're pressed for time, I'm not sure how much detail you want me to go into today, but we went through it and highlighted a series of different items that we would suggest you consider for fees. I also proposed a phase-in period over 2 years. The full effect of the fees wouldn't take place this year, not only in the form of revenue, but they would be phased in over 2 years. So it's so I could go through the formal process of or the evaluation. I can just go to the spreadsheet that shows what the proposed fees were, are, and this sheet has actually been updated just a little bit to make it a little more clear.
to you as you look at this today. If a number is in red on the sheet, it means we're already collecting this amount of money. So we basically are collecting $100 for development agreements, we're collecting $100 for supplemental development agreements, and we're collecting $100 currently for revocable permits. And in 2016, we're not suggesting that any of those change. In 2017, those would go up then to reflect our actual cost, which would be $500 for a development agreement, $200 for a supplemental development agreement, which is basically a revision to that agreement, and $200 for revocable permits. The other fees on the spreadsheet here are new again, unless they're in red. And we do have some miscellaneous permits that we have now in the way of noise and air space agreements. If you call them development agreements, those are attachments. There's recording fees and things associated with that. None of these fees include the cost of recording. So when these documents get recorded at the county recorder's office, there's about a $46 fee roughly. These numbers do not reflect that. So these would just be, because that's currently revenue that you're collecting. We do collect the recording fee now on any documents that does get approved by you and should be recorded for future reference by the current and future property owners. So sidewalk permit fees, driveway permit fees, utility connection permits, obstruction permits are primarily the new areas. These revenues will generate in this calendar year, would generate a total collected for the full year of roughly $102,000. We're already collecting about $11,500, again, with the ones that are in red. So the net new increase in revenues for the calendar year in 2016 would be $91,000. Obviously, you haven't adopted these yet, so it would be prorated. It would be a prorated amount, again, based on development activity that would occur between the official date that you would designate in the resolution as to when these could go in effect. So, again, you have that option. You could say it could be effective May 1st, July 1st, whatever date you would select. The cost of the position with benefits was estimated, I think it was in the memo that I sent to you, was estimated to be about $82,000 for the year. So again, that's prorated. So again, if you were to authorize this, it's not likely to have somebody on board in that position until about June 1st at the earliest. So again, you'd have to raise about half of this $91,000 for that period of time. Once the second phase were to go into effect in 2017 as proposed, it would generate about $149,000 worth of total revenue. Again, there's $11,500 that's currently, I'm sorry, that would be the net new increase in revenue, would be more than enough to pay for the position. But again, as we've had during the discussions during budget about the fact that some have suggested the entire division be funded with fees, since all of their activities are related to development. So this isn't a beginning to get there, but it does go, obviously it covers the cost of the new position.
Okay. Why don't I see if there are questions? You're right, there's a fair amount of material. Questions from the council?
How does this stack up with fees of similar sized cities? I know we've already heard that we've got a lot of fees, and this is kind of thrown at us. And I guess I'm wondering why the numbers are changed here too from what we got. Is that
it was basically a quality control check by Mark after I sent it to you, and he pointed out that I made a few errors in what I'd sent out. So
how we stack up, nice to see how we stack up for, regional cities and so on.
I didn't do any comparison because the council wasn't really asking for that. The discussion, as I recall, during the budget is, these are costs that benefit a particular few people in the community, so why are the taxpayers paying for this? So we didn't compare these to other cities. We could do that if you like, but we haven't done that so far.
Okay.
And have you had discussions with the ride share builders about this?
There's been discussions all on and off over the last couple of years, but they have not seen this information. This specific table, all the other information that you had at budget time was something that they had an opportunity to review. So the memos and stuff were part of your budget packets. The only thing that's new is the table today.
I think it's a good direction to be heading in to, you know, associate the needs to fund this stuff from those that are deriving the benefit from the services. My only question is that the assumption I have is that all of these fees are less than or equal to the amount, the cost of providing all of these services.
They're calculated based on our estimate of the cost to prepare the documents. On an average, you know, any given document could take longer or take less time or take more time, but it's based on the average cost.
And then in my eyes, then it's incredibly fair to the community, and ultimately, the cost is not changing. It's a matter of who's paying for it, and this is, you know, putting the fees on the beneficiaries as opposed to the greater community. And I think that that's a.
Although I think a fair question would be, so what's the value? In other words, and I'm just posing this question. In other words, so the work is obviously getting done today. So if we add this position and a commensurate fee, what will I see if I'm a builder or developers? Are things going to move faster, or
that's the intent basically? Is it time is money?
I'm just saying that's the case you'll want to make is, you know, where's the value here?
Right. As I understand it, on page 22 in the memorandum, you know, it's going to provide better service because now it seems as if you're a little bit strained. And this additional staff is going to give the opportunity to satisfy the developers and adhere to our quality standards in the meantime as well. But as it continues, when you indicated, Mr. Freeze, that you had, let's see, your staff had increased by, oops, your workload had increased significantly with one less staff member.
Since 2011. So again, during the downturn, we didn't come back and ask that position be filled. We recognized the fact that the workload was down, and we've basically been able to get by, if you will, or get the work done. But I know how many hours the staff work to get the work done, and in particular, the division director spends probably easy 60 hours a week working on these activities, if not more. And so as development activity now is picked up, we're suggesting that the addition of the position would be warranted, and this would be a way that you could fund those costs.
Mr. Campion?
Your documentation was thorough, and I thought that this was a really great way to present a use case and a suggestion for how we can meet a clear need. So I'm supportive of this. I'd like to see it come forward as RCA so we can get this done.
Mr. Hickey,
any thoughts from city administration on this as it relates to your
I think budget? Actually, my sort of view that you approved the position at budget time, and it was just subject to the fees being brought forward to fund it. So, from my viewpoint, I would think that your judgment on whether or not you should have the position was already made. It's a matter of how you fund it. Mm-hmm.
All right. Anyone else? Mr. Ruska?
I guess. John, would you mind? It's John here. Would you mind just like sharing your thoughts, because this is going to. Do you see, as Randy alluded to earlier, the added value that you guys would see here? Is it justified, the fees? Are they fair? Is it something that you're gonna is much needed? And you guys have been in
We had that. We're always hesitant about fees, but that's just kind of who we are. Mr. Wojcik is obviously aware of the state statute because you cannot charge more than services rendered. That's what Richard presented. If we're always for steps that will improve the process and streamline the process, so that's encouraging to hear that it would streamline the process. We've also been advocating for another position, as you well know. So,
from that standpoint, it would be, I'd have to get back feedback from some of our members, but if it's going to help with the process, and as Richard said, we were involved, we being, I don't know, 15 or 20 members within the development committee, were involved in the discussions leading up to the ordinance change. So, Chris, you have any comments?
Well, just another part of that is there were many communities that were compared, so that, and it's really difficult because every community has a different system for establishing fees, but I think John's right that the idea that if we can improve the process and process development applications and these different permits in a more timely manner is certainly a benefit to the building community as well as the general community. So okay. I guess that'd be my point of view. David might have a different point of view.
Well, I'm actually at a point, and I'm agreeing with Mr. Campion, why wouldn't we just go ahead and bring this, because we wouldn't decide it today anyway, bring it forward as an RCA and then kind of see how it comes out. People will have a chance to see and comment on it prior to that that decision.
It'll be an RCA with a resolution that would establish the fees for 2016 and 2017 is what I would propose.
To accommodate or those costs of that added position.
In a roundabout way.
Yes. So is your guy that works 60 hours and more now going to only work 40?
You know, Mr. Ruska said that facetiously, but the fact is we've had a reduction in staff and increase in work. So your minimal was very compelling, I think, especially when you documented it more than doubled, has increased by 143%. I bet we could replicate some of these numbers if we sent it out to every director in our city. So thank you for what you do.
Well, I just anecdotally, I was communicating with several of you a week ago Sunday, and the reason I was on, because I can always expect that probably Mark's going to be communicating with me Saturday and Sunday too, so I'm checking to see if I can be responsive to him. So, I mean, it's an ongoing effort to try to be, again, get as much done as we can with the staff that we have, but it's, the workload is picking up, and it's picking up rather significantly.
Yeah. Mr. Russell.
I guess I just am hoping that they see a direct impact on the quality, the quality and timing of the work, versus, just that we keep status quo. I hope that this is a significant, efficiency, increase in efficiency here. So.
Yep.
That would be our intent.
Okay. All right. So, and again, I didn't mean to cut Mr. Kane off, but I think we're pretty much there where we've made it clear we would want to see value for what we're doing, our investment here in a new position. And they would want to see value in terms of the additional fees that they're going to be asked to pay.
And I break that apart a little bit and say that I expect that they'll see value from the new position. I think the fee should be done regardless because they're costs that we're incurring. And I the two happen to work together here, but these are real costs that we're facing as a city, so I'm glad the fees are there.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you're going to see an RCA.
Yes, thank you.
All right, we have one final topic. Consideration of development informational meeting text amendment, which we have from Ms. Baker, I believe. I don't know if this might be the best time to get a comment out that I know there were some memorandums circulating specifically related to CUED and so forth, and what Ms. Baker has brought forward is some potential language addressing the roles and responsibilities of neighborhood associations in the overall process and the communication timeline and so forth. In my opinion, I think the mission, scope, whatever, of any of the advisory bodies, CUED, Energy, Heritage Preservation, I kind of separated those in my mind, at least not expecting to talk about that today. Is that just me, or?
I agree.
In other words, I didn't want to get all of the committees or advisory groups up in arms because I wasn't looking to solve or resolve that today.
Mr. Ruskin. But I guess I think to be fair to everybody, we should probably put that as an issue that we need to discuss.
I agree.
Eventually, that, you know, clarity and, you know, we've got good people out here trying to figure out where they fit in, and people that are working with them trying to figure out where they fit in, and maybe not some clarity on direction. So I think that is another discussion that I think we should have. If it's not today, I agree it shouldn't be today, but I think it should be soon here.
Yeah, that was my opinion.
I concur.
All right, so Ms. Baker.
So the City Council had tabled a text amendment in September, primarily in response to a request to have some additional time for one to review the amendment and evaluate how it might affect certain audiences. Two main things we were really trying to do with this was to clean up a gap in certain applications that did not require a neighborhood meeting. There were just a few, and we had to meet exceptions in order to be exempted from the neighborhood meeting, and we found that was more confusing than it was beneficial, so we just thought we'd close that gap. In all the things that require a public hearing in front of Planning Commission Council, we require one of these meetings. But just clean that up. The other thing that we'd suggested was changing the timing of that meeting so that it would occur prior to submitting an application proposal to the city. Primarily because it gives the development community the opportunity to consider any changes they want to make and make them before they submit to us, so that we don't get midstream changes later after they've had those further discussions. Those midstream changes have caused friction at the Planning Commission meetings and at the City Council meetings because we get them late, we can't be responsive enough. We just spent 98% of our time already on that application, processing, analyzing, coordinating, preparing reports. And when we talk about fees and fee recovery, when we have to redo those things, it costs us again. It's not efficient. It causes inefficiencies and frictions in the process. So we thought we'd suggest some things to help clean that up. The other thing was to try to help manage the expectation of what the meeting was for and who it was for. Really focusing on this being an informational meeting about a development and not necessarily a neighborhood's specific meeting for the neighborhood, but it's an informational meeting for the development. Including adjacent property owners, sometimes it's in a neighborhood, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's commercial property surrounded by other commercial properties. So those were the main things that we had recommended changes for. You'll see in the memo that we did meet with RAB after they initiated some discussions around that. We have not sat down with our neighbors, and the name of one was here and had to leave for another commitment. But I assured her this is not scheduled for a public hearing yet, and there's time for us to sit down with our neighbors' representatives if they'd like to talk through any of these changes. I was reminded today that there were several people who spoke in favor of the text amendment when it was in front of the City Council, favoring the change to the timing of the meeting so it would happen in advance and closing the gap on those particular projects that were exempted from neighborhood meetings. So there was some favorable feedback at that time. I will try to answer any questions you might have this time.
So I've got a couple right out of the gate. It looked like, and I know you had some consultation with the area builders, there seemed to be two items where you had a difference of opinion. First was who is responsible for mailing out the notices. I think your opinion, Mitzi, was that should be the responsibility of the developer or whoever's holding the meeting, and they thought vice versa. My opinion on that one was that I like a single source of information, and I think the planning department / city probably have the best database of information. Or were you saying that you'd be the keeper of the data, but they would be responsible for sending it out, the notices?
The neighborhood informational meeting requirement went into the ordinance maybe 10 plus years ago.
Right.
And since then, we have been the source of data, providing the mailing list, because we do have that data, and we use the same data for mailing out public hearing notices. So we've provided that to the consultant or developer so they can use it for sending out their notices. And we found over the years that different audiences have different preferences for what they send. You can send a postcard. But if they want to send information, including full sheets, graphics, folded with, or full-size unfolded mailings, they bear the burden of that. Mm-hmm. If we send it, we can. If you are interested in having that change made and having our office send it, I would still ask that we limit that to a postcard. Because starting to stuff envelopes, and looking at equipment and staffing, that's going to be a bigger issue.
And that's all I was thinking about, the postcard notification, yep. Mr. Campion.
Same. Yep. If we have to send it, in my opinion, because we are the transparent body that can be Freedom of Information Acted to make sure we're operating clearly. And if someone has a concern that they feel they're being left out, you know, then we're the public body who's doing it. It's not the developer. You know, we don't have this tit-for-tat thing between the development community and some neighbors. It's not, I just think it clears the process very, from my perspective, having penned dozens of these, that that to me is a thing we can do that makes us look capable and also gives the citizens some certainty that we'll be reaching out to them, that they can rest assured that we'll be contacting them. So my perspective on that one is, you know, we've charged the development community to do it, but that we do it.
So, Mr. Bill, go back then.
I totally agree with Mr. Campion. I think if the developer wishes to send out multiple pages and schematics, that's up to them to do. But I believe Mr. Campion's dead spot on. We need to have the consistency. We need to make sure it goes out. So I think it's fine to have our group have the plan to do it.
I particularly like the fact that when somebody claims, oh, I never received this, we can at least go back and take a look at the list of where we sent them and see if they were on that list or not. You know, that's very helpful from our standpoint. I agree with Mr. Campion. We send it out, but the developer pays for it at their expense.
All right. So the second item was the staff attendance at informational meetings. And I can understand where that would be problematic. It's good to have them there as an informational resource to ask questions, but I can understand also that they could potentially be put on a spot. Well, don't you think this is, you know, right or wrong? And they're not going to render that decision, so it creates some tension that doesn't need to occur. Mr. Ross?
I guess I like the idea. In all the meetings that I've been to, I think it's only been once or twice that I've asked staff to be there, and they've accommodated me because of a lot of detail or questions or circumstances that gives us a little bit of defining of the policies and the laws and the applications. So I guess I don't think we should require it, but I like the idea. I think, Mitzi, you guys have been open to it. If we've said, hey, we got a big project coming forward here, and there's quite a few questions, would you mind sending a staff person? It's worked out pretty well. So I like the idea of it still being an option, but I don't care to require it. I think it's the staff has. There's a lot of meetings and a lot of things going on, and there's only so much staff to go around. So, I guess I'd like to kind of not require it.
So, and that's the language you have in here. As I look at the draft language, sentence reads: City staff may attend such meetings to gather information to highlight relevant requirements of this ordinance as needed, but shall not organize or control a meeting.
I believe that's the current language.
Right. So that's what you're advocating that we keep.
What I was suggesting,
so it's optional.
After the word may, comma, but is not required to, comma.
That sounds good.
Okay. Ms. Means, you had a question?
I'll wait until. I was going to comment on the draft statement, but that's jumping around a little bit.
Okay. And those were just my two lead-off questions. Those seem to be the open questions between staff and RAB, at least. Mr. Wojak?
With the I actually share the goal. I understand why, you know, somebody might want staff to be there, you know, almost as a referee. But if we could get one thing out of this that I think has been a huge drag on the development process, that would, I think, give the neighborhood a lot more comfort. I think for the most part, these things are going to come to the neighborhoods after some sort of a pre-development meeting, which means the developer already has a pretty good indication of what staff feels about the project. But where neighborhoods have had a great deal of frustration is where they identify something that's in, for example, an adopted underlying plan, which for an incentive development requires compliance. And they point out these inconsistencies, but they don't have any feedback on those inconsistencies. So rather than forcing staff to be there, I'd like to at least have a process where, you know, after these meetings, if neighborhoods have concern about some inconsistency, there's at least a feedback mechanism for that, short of coming up and having a big battle at a public hearing.
Okay. Comments? Mr. Campion.
I don't know what that process looks like, but the goal for me for this entire thing, and I think we probably are in unison about this, is to reduce the volume of city council meeting time that's spent resolving these conflicts. And I think getting it started earlier, I think staff did a slam dunk job, frankly, on the timing of this. Yeah. Makes a lot more sense in the new language. Really, I think that's a huge benefit for the city. But, you know, what that process looks like, frankly, today, that process looks like my inbox getting filled up and me referring, you know, concerns to staff. If it's appropriate that we have a more formal process, that once we take those notes, meeting notes from, you know, we have this process that's kind of semi-formal or formal, that we get a readout of all the questions that were asked and commentary. You know, I don't know what the process looks like, but I can see it being valuable to get feedback that points out, here are the principal concerns from a neighborhood association in the area. I also like that too, because it goes to this idea of not moving the goalposts. You know, get on record, get your concerns listed.
Yep.
And let's work them out as a cooperative unit here to get positives for the community. So, you have a thought on what a process like that would look like, or you have?
Well, I'll go back to the public hearing. So, under state statute and local law, public hearings are required for specific reasons, and that is the official, transparent, and open public process for concerns, objections, support, disputes, disagreements are to be aired and registered and logged in the public record, and to be aired and registered with the decision-making bodies, whether they're giving a recommendation to council or the council's decision. And so that those comments are directly before you as you are making your decision, and they end up in the findings of fact that the legal staff put together for you, that pull together all the evidence in which you base your decisions. So the neighborhood meetings have a different purpose. The state statute doesn't say you must go to a neighborhood meeting and have a discussion around this project and make some determination about agreement at that level. Mm-hmm. It happens here.
And I'm not looking to make that a point of agreement necessarily. What I'm trying to do is develop a process that gets the road bumps visible as early as possible.
Right.
So I think,
yep,
from a changing the time, that's a great change.
I think it's very helpful, but I know that not everybody will like the draft statement that was put in your packet, but part of the hope with that is to lay out for the public that there has not been a technical and professional review of the project yet, and that review in itself may require some changes to be made. So that the project is subject to some change. So again, that's why the public hearings become so much more important, because the commission and council should be working with a fuller packet of information. We're not going to be able to produce that in advance of those hearings.
Well, and I also like that this gets on the radar, the problems earlier, so that when comes the idea of a fuller packet, we're not getting 18 pages of special district language at the 11th hour. You know, we're getting it ahead of time, so we have some time to consume it. But circling back maybe to the thing that got me started here, I'm not looking to codify it as a decision point. I'm looking to steer these informational meetings to also be the start of kind of this discussion that I think has proven valuable between the developer and other people who see themselves or are stakeholders in this process, frankly, the community. And if we can get them talking, man, it's surprising how many of these things can resolve themselves. Not everything. We're going to be there. But I don't want to get it being perfect get in the way of good that we have in front of us. So I'm not going to look to hold anything up, but I hope you're hearing this airing of, it would be interesting to see if you guys had suggestions for this process of how does a neighborhood, how do we codify what a neighborhood's feelings are? How does someone put in their concerns in a way that's visible to the entire council? So, Mr. Campion, you forward this on to the council.
Well, I think part of that is in the notice. I mean, it says in there, you know, we've tried to put in there that explaining you should not just rely on your conversations with the developer. You have a responsibility, you know, to get those comments and the planning into the council. So
sure.
That's something that we, that was stuck in this notice that I think wasn't in the last one.
You know, in front of that was, when folks come to these meetings, we don't know if they understand, but they have the opportunity to register those comments with us, and we will carry them forward to Planning Commission and Council. Doesn't mean we agree with all of them, but
right.
They're part of your decision-making packet.
Okay.
It's really trying to encourage that audience to submit their comments to us, whereas the development community is already submitting their version of the summary, right? If they want to take responsibility for making sure their own individual comments as a neighborhood or adjacent property owner are registered. We think we're trying to encourage that in that statement.
Mr. Ruska, then Ms. Means.
Well, I guess I was just kind of thinking that, you know, we can apply judgment to this too. If there's additional needs or we're hearing a lot of concern or confusion, we can plan additional meetings with the neighbors on our own to try to work through some of those things and to try to get some of them done, as you know, like 5-1 that you did this week. You know, sometimes working on trying to get people to the table and discussing these things ahead of the public hearing also can be beneficial. And sometimes on the bigger projects, we don't all have big projects every week in our ward, but we do have them at different times, and I think sometimes we have to dig in a little deeper and try to get through some a little bit more. So that, I guess, Nick, that's my thought, is if there's something that we see that there's really an issue out there, then maybe we try to have, you know, get an extra meeting together before it comes to hearing to try to help people understand it.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's tough with timing and all that, too, I agree.
And I also understand that this, you have to look at this, and I know you do, but you have to look at it from the perspective of, I may have one development project happen near me in my lifetime. In my, you know, the time I'm a resident of Rochester, you may get one postcard in the mail. And from the perspective of that individual, are we doing enough to educate them so that they can voice their opinion? I don't know. This goes a ways. I'm glad to see we're out in front of it and that we're setting this up and make it mandatory. I'm gonna reserve for the comment, maybe.
May I ask a question, though? Is there any sentiment from the council that the statement can help encourage and inform attendees at these meetings to submit their comments directly to the board?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Yep. Ms. Means?
I just wanted to comment on the draft statement, but I want to thank you for trying to put this together. It's pretty explicit, I think. The draft statement that must be read at the meetings, it seemed to me is pretty lengthy. And I wondered if it would be appropriate to have some bulleted items. So, because I don't know if they would really read all of this, but if there were some specific points that you could address and then have the full detail submitted as the handout at the meeting. Specifically, I had started this, you know, the meeting is twofold. It's an opportunity to show that the proposed project in advance of public hearing by the City Planning and Zoning and City Council. Number two, it would be an opportunity to inform for informal dialogue and information sharing. You know what I mean? It's just so it just pops right out. What is the expectation here? What are we going to give and what are you going to get back? The other thing I noticed is that the public decision bodies for consideration by the city, you know, should we be more specific in identifying who those contacts are, or what name of the department would be, for example. You know what I mean? Public decision bodies. I think about that as being council. Is it?
Commission, council, and zoning board of appeals. Okay. Those are the three bodies that are referenced in the land development manual for actions on land rezoning.
So perhaps even those should be identified so they'll know exactly what you're talking about for consideration by the city. Okay.
Mr. Miller, and
those are just the kind of things that I could, you know, speak to you about it later or send you some of my written documents on it. But I just think it's too much to have and expect that it's going to be done without highlighting through bullets. Fact sheet.
Mr. Bilderback.
And I basically like this. I think it makes a lot of sense to get it out in front of the public quicker. I think you did hit on the point. The big problem is people need to know what they can do with that information, because there are have been times where you've had public meetings or meetings with developers and you have two sides. And the only side that most people think gets represented is the side of the developer. So I think it's important for us in all phases as we go through this to make sure the public realizes they can submit their comments as well, and then that becomes a part of the record. I think that's been a part that's been missing, and I think that's the part that we have to, and Nick's right, trying to figure out exactly how do we make sure that happens is the big, is the key. And I agree. I think it's going to have to be an education piece, and I think we need to make sure it's there in the ordinance, as well as when we meet with people that we remind them of that.
Does it make sense to have a handout or something standard to put at these informational meetings?
Well, in concept, the statement would actually be distributed to
everyone. I don't know if I want the full statement, but what I would be exceptionally useful is here are the bodies to contact. Here is the email address you send it to that will get them contacted. And I know the city has a website to get to, but if I can type in citycouncil@rochmn.gov and send an email, I think we might get a few more contacts than what we do today. But ultimately, you know, some standard handout that when you pay your fee for us to send the emails for your public notice, we hand you a stack and factor that cost into the total cost of this process, I think would be very useful to have them sit them down. I mean, I usually have everyone, but and I can put my cards out so people can get me. But having something standard in case, you know, we get sick or someone has to miss one, I think could be a real, real benefit.
Yeah, Mr. Hickey.
So I like the statement, and I agree there's a lot here, but I think it's important. And I like the idea that it's read aloud at the beginning, and then you've got the written copies to back it up. So when someone hears this at the beginning of the meeting, it is a lot. They may not take it all in, but it's like, you know what I think I heard? Let me see the follow-up of the written material. Whereas without that oral statement up front, they've not had that prompting to go to the written. So I like the statement, and I like the format, but it's an oral statement with a written copy to back it up.
Yep. A very abbreviated bulleted list.
No, you're saying you like the original, the full text.
I do. Yeah. I mean, I think we could certainly, you know, I'm not saying that there can't be things that can be modified. But I do like it.
For the handout, I really like, here are the bullets.
Really?
You know, this isn't the decision.
Well, you can have the Cliff Notes version and for the interested student.
You love Cliff Notes and PowerPoints, right?
So, correct. You can do both.
All right. Mr. Russell.
Just a quick question for Stephen. Is there a way that the city could help provide some of the meeting space for some of these meetings, like this room, for instance? Is there some way that these rooms can be reserved for these type of meetings?
We'll try to accommodate as much as possible. We do have some, we'll have to make sure we have a custodian present after hours, but we'll try to accommodate whenever possible.
Good to have some reservable space for those meetings.
Yeah, honestly, I've actually been, staff's been actually helping me with that for about 8 years now, so I just tell them when they want the meeting, and I think unless there's been a conflict, they've always been able to do it. So.
But I mean, is the developer able to do that? That's what I'm getting at. I mean, I know we can request it, but, you know, if someone, an outside developer wants to come in and
do it. We'll do our best to accommodate them.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Thank you.
All right. So where are we at with this? Where would you like to go? We have a proposed statement, both this draft item that would be read at the beginning meeting. We've got some ordinance language, and we've got the suggestion for an additional handout that succinctly provides some follow-up information. I think we said that we like planning to take responsibility for sending out the postcard. If the developer wants to send out more, that's on their dime.
They can still get the addresses from you, I would guess.
Right, and they would have to take care of the mail.
Sure.
Right.
I had one other thing that came up in a neighborhood.
leader kind of reviewed this. He said it looked like maybe we dropped the site plan reviews from the list of things that would mandate a meeting. Is that, was that intentional or was that accidental?
I think what it was is closing the loop. We just called out all conditional use permits and so forth. So it would, we took out a reference to a specific kind of conditional use permit.
Okay.
And just, it became more encompassing.
And so the idea is if these, if a site plan, for instance, is proposed at the time the GDP or other elements come forward, you would have one. But if you went away for a period of time and came back with a site plan somewhere significantly down the road, would you have to have another informational meeting still?
I don't think standard site plans ever required these, right? And I'm going to point to Dave because he worked on that piece of them.
That is part of those that say strongly encouraged. So that's one of the things we wanted to eliminate was that language of different ideas and then say strongly encouraged. I don't think for our site development plans those were generally occurring, but it did say strongly encouraged in the current text, and what we want to do is clean that up and make sure that we're hitting on the projects and the development proposals where there's the most need, and certainly that would be those type 3 conditional use permits and making sure that that's kind of.
I hate to be the contrarian. I'm a bit concerned about how much of the project becomes relevant when at the site plan process. So we've seen things like drive-through orientations. That can be a huge change to a project if it's facing the neighborhood, if it's away from the neighborhood. So I guess I'd like to have some assurance that when a site plan comes forward, these important elements of the neighborhood are being presented instead of, you know, we're just showing some boxes on a site plan or on a thing and calling it a GDP and showing that, because that can lead to a lot of animosity when they go, I don't know what these boxes look like.
They weren't required before, no. Just so we're clear, they were not required. And the other thing I just want to throw out there is when there are expectations that the city has about site design and development and layouts, they ought to be codified in the ordinance so that everybody knows what those are. And typically administered at the staff level. They shouldn't have to be subjected to public review every time something comes forward. If there's an expectation from the community that X, Y, and Z get done, that should be in the policy.
Do you find it, so okay, let's just talk plainly about this. We're going to talk, I'm going as a developer to present to a neighborhood. You can understand, though, how being able to visualize, you know, as not zoning experts and people that may have never had a development done nearby, they may not know, I mean, I get questions, what's an R1? They're not going to know that what can be developed in this box. So I guess I see it as extremely useful to this idea that we're trying to defuse situations that cause last-minute contention during council meetings.
I think my point here, though, is that when there are plans that meet the ordinance, if they go to the neighborhood and the neighborhood wants something different, there's nothing that you can require that be different if they comply with the policies that are in place, because the city has already decided that X, Y, and Z are your criteria. And if you meet X, Y, and Z, you should be able to get your permit and go.
Sure. No, I guess my point is more along the lines of when they show up and we want to consider this informational meeting, what level of material has to be present? And we're saying today that we don't need a site plan to hold a neighborhood informational meeting, right?
I misunderstood where you headed. So a site plan is a specific kind of application that is typically a staff-level review.
Right.
And I thought you were trying to include that into the required neighborhood meetings, which is not...
Yes, he is.
I'm trying to make sure that when you go to talk to a neighborhood, you have a site plan.
Right.
Because that is where so often we hit these really important things about parking orientation and all these other things that are very important to neighbors.
If that was omitted as a piece of information to share at the meeting, we can add that back in.
Okay. At a minimum, I'd like to see it there, and I'd like some maybe for some commentary about whether or not it makes sense to require it for site plans that may come through separately. They may do a GDP and come back much later. I don't know what the timeline is. They may come back at some much later date with an actual site plan. You know, do you have to have a site plan to do an informational meeting? Maybe that's, I mean, I'm just concerned that what I
what I'm worried about is people that feel like they've been baited and switched. And mm-hmm. and that's the worst case scenario is it gets in front of the council and we have a bunch of contention about something that may have been alleviated if they had seen the site plan earlier.
So with respect to time, and we're not going to take action on this tonight anyway, and we've given some comments and so forth, I'd like to perhaps bring this back
yep.
for some further discussion.
Absolutely. Yep.
So I'll schedule it.
I want to make sure that we're entirely clear, though. This is a huge step forward. I want there to be no uncertainty
right.
about that. I really think this is a positive step, so I appreciate all the work you guys are doing to do it.
Okay.
We should look at that.
We should look at April.
I think our first opportunity is April 4th, because next week is our joint meeting with the county.
We'll schedule for April 4th.
The only topic we have on April 4th is an update on the affordable housing plan, which I'm going to take 10 minutes.
I'd like to meet with our neighbors too.
Perfect.
Doesn't take long to say yes.
You're still open then for the neighborhoods to get comments to you?
Certainly. Yep.
Okay, so April 4th.
This is a public hearing process. Register your comments.
There you go.
Right?
Perfect.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
See everyone this evening.